If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Buzz around artificial intelligence is seemingly everywhere. Is your portfolio keeping up? Consider the Global X Artificial Intelligence and Technology ETF, ticker AIQ, which invests in dozens of stocks at the leading edge of this disruption. Investing involves risk, including possible loss of principal. Technology companies can be affected by rapid product obsolescence and intense industry competition. Before investing, carefully consider the fund's objectives, risks, charges, expenses, and more in the full or summary prospectus at globalxetfs.com. Read carefully. Distributed by SEI Investments Distribution Co.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. First of all, Happy New Year. And on this podcast, we've got a suitably bizarre slice of history to kick off 2021. If there's something I learnt from the conversation that you're about to hear, it's that people have made some incredibly weird books down the ages. I was speaking to the author Edward Brooke Hitching about his book, The Madman's Library, a compendium of some of the most curious books and manuscripts ever made. And as you'll hear, some of them are very strange indeed.
I think for anyone who's ever been caught up in the romance of an old library or a secondhand bookshop, your book is essentially a dream come true, because what it is a collection of some of the weirdest, and I think it's fair to say some of them are really very weird, books and manuscripts that have ever been written. Can you give us a flavour of the range of texts that you collect in it?
Yeah, it's like you say, it's incredibly widely varied, because the whole point of the book was to think, well, what are not just the books, but the kinds of books or the kinds of pockets in the history of printing and pre-printing in terms of the history of the written word that people might not have come across, that might only be known if you studied that specific field in your academic past and things like that. So, I mean, it ranges, it was just anything that had a great story to it. So it ranges from themes of edible books, wearable books, books that aren't books. So going back, thousands of years before the Codex, which is what we refer to, obviously, when we talk about the book today, quires of pages bound together between two hard materials. So it's looking at every possible way that a definition of a book has been stretched and broken in the past and currently around the world. So there's books made of cheese. There are books that were designed to sort of injure or kill, books written by the devil, books that are so large, theoretically, if they were printed, they'd destroy the universe. I mean, that's the kind of flavor. It's a sort of Baskin-Robbins approach. It's just hundreds of different flavors, and you can dip in when you want to and taste different things as you go along.
I think that's a perfect summary of it, ranging from books made of cheese to books written by the devil. These aren't exactly, yes. you know, the hardbacks and paperbacks that you're picking up in Waterstones. I'm going to just go straight in at the deep end with my first question here and ask, I couldn't quite believe how many books, it turns out, have been bound in human skin. Why?
Yeah, well, quite. I mean, that isn't that the first question? It's mind-boggling. It's so, it's pretty offensive to our modern sensibilities. And we've got these notions of, the Nazis doing nefarious thing, making lamps with human skins. It seems like just an incredibly sadistic, psychopathic thing to do. But, you know, as with anything in history, you have to sort of interrogate, is something that happened in our past, and you do have to examine, well, why? And as it turns out, it was a perfectly acceptable at the time decorative extra offered by printers and binders. And when you think, well, what could possibly fit with a human skin binding? What kind of work would go inside that, other than a book like a history of human skin binding? What you find is really there's three different genres of literature as this art. I don't know if it evolved, but as it developed, and initially you find it used to bind the records of criminals, murderers, people who, we really wanted to make an example out of it, just how savage and terrible and anathema to decent law-abiding society these sort of outliers are, and make an example of them. And what better way to symbolically punish someone who commits these unthinkable crimes by physically binding them and turning them into the greatest symbol of civilization, the book. And so there are examples of, I mean, they're fairly well known, but I think we also consider perhaps they're cloaked in rumor as well. We're not quite sure how many are confirmed examples of human skin, but there are murderers. There's a famous example of a highwayman who presented a copy of his autobiography on his deathbed. He left orders that it would be delivered to his only victim who fought back and survived. And the highwayman actually sort of shot at him, but the bullet ricocheted off the man's belt buckle. And so the highwayman was so impressed with this act of bravery that he left him a copy of his autobiography bound in his own skin. And as you move away from criminal accounts, you move into the field of medicine, and curious medical cases would be bound by surgeons in the skin of the subject, really as a way of memorializing this person, in a sense, showing just how special they were, and not just because of the unusual ailment that they suffered from. And then it evolves into more of a romantic metaphor in the 19th century, when this is still very much going on. And the idea became more about encapsulating great literature, great works of art, in flesh, in the same way that the body encapsulates the soul. And the most famous example of that is Camille Flammarion, the French writer, astronomer, who, and this is a story that he confirmed to the newspapers, was at a party when he complimented a young countess on her beautiful skin, the charm of her skin. It turned out that she was dying of a terminal illness, I presume tuberculosis or something. And one day later, there's a knock at his door, and there's a French surgeon standing there with a package saying he just flayed the, quote, marvelously attractive young woman, who had left orders on her deathbed that her skin be presented to her hero, Flammarion, for him to bind his latest work in, whatever that might be. So there's a copy of his book, Les Terres du Ciel, from 1877, bound in this charming skin of the Countess. And it actually, it goes on into the early 20th century, but then it becomes more, the references that you find looking for evidence of it become more recollections of binders and printers. And especially with, you know, little things like world wars going on, it just becomes so sort of disgusting and antithetical to good taste that it dies away.
As you say, I think that's what's so intriguing about these stories, that we just balk at that idea as something incredibly grisly and macabre, but actually the motivations weren't necessarily macabre in themselves. If we're talking about books made from the human body, as we are, then I have to ask you also about Saddam Hussein, who features in the book. I wonder if you could explain to the listeners why I'm bringing him up.
Again, yes, exactly. I'm a perfect example of an astoundingly curious work, written work. And it's a story that I think I heard at the time and again thought it was maybe a little rumor, but a lot of people I meet have never heard of it. So in 1997, Saddam Hussein commissioned a master calligrapher of Baghdad to create a, I think it's an 805-page copy of the Quran manuscript, to be written in Saddam Hussein's own blood. So over a period of, I think, 2 years, he had around 50 pints of his own blood withdrawn and to be mixed in with the ink and the calligraphic chemicals. And this work, the Blood Quran of Saddam Hussein, was produced. Now, obviously, this is not your average man creating something like this, and it's very much deemed a total monstrosity in Islam to do such. It's completely haram and forbidden to do this. But the fascinating thing is it presents... continues to present a dilemma to its archivists, who bundle it away after the fall of Baghdad into an archive somewhere under the streets of Baghdad. And no one knows to this day what to do with it, because it's forbidden to create it, but it's also forbidden to destroy a Quran. And it did go on display. I do include a photo of it, amazingly, in the book, showing it behind its pages out on display in this glass case. So we know it did, at least did exist, if it doesn't still. And it sits there, supposedly, in this archive, of which there are three separate keys needed to open it. Each one is given to a different public official, so no one can just sort of sneak in and have a peek. And there it lies. But in terms of the tradition of blood writing, this was a fairly recent example of a very long ancient art. And I go back all the way looking at the practice in sort of Buddhist writing, where it's deemed a sort of an ascetic act of sacrifice, earning good karma to sort of prick your skin, snap your bones, and write in giving yourself to the literature, imbuing yourself and it with this sort of divine power. But you can shift all over the place. So alongside this, if you think, well, in a theoretical library, which is essentially what this collection is, what would sit on the shelf beside it? And so I remember talking to a book dealer at Mags Brothers, a great sort of London rare bookshop. And she said, oh yeah, blood writing. Yes. Now, a few years ago, we did have a copy of a diary of a shipwreck from, I think, 1842 called the Blenden Hall. And the captain and a few others survived. And all the captain had at his disposal to keep records was a few bundles of the Times that had washed ashore, a writing desk, pens, but no ink. And so he used what was available to him. So the subtitle of this book, Fate of the Blenden Hall, is written in the blood of the penguin. And it was entirely written in penguin blood, which is astonishing. And then you discover that in 1977, there was a Marvel Comics book that was put out featuring the American rock band Kiss, who agreed to have their blood withdrawn to be mixed in with the ink. And this comic book was printed with blood and proclaims on the outside, written in the blood of Kiss. It was a huge selling point. So it's fascinating to sort of dart around and see these various completely contrasting examples of the same method of production.
When I've been reading this book in preparation for the interview, as much as it's about books, what it really illustrates to me is how strange and bizarre some humans through history and their behaviours have been, and how obsessive almost and dedicated to creating certain things people have been. It's as much about eccentric people that made books as the books themselves. Who were some of the most eccentric people that you featured in the book?
Oh, I mean, yes, what you've hit on is something that I'm basically using in many examples books just to tell my favorite stories of these eccentric characters. It's just an excuse. I mean, thinking randomly, there are so many in there, but I think one example that I remember reading this book and thinking it had to be, it's a classic example of wondering whether it was a hoax in itself. But there was a gentleman, an American clergyman, who produced a book in 1858 called John Murray Spear, who claimed to channel the spirits of various American presidents, which he called the Association of Electricizers. And he commanded quite a following because he was clearly slightly out of his mind. So very charismatic. He and his, for want of a better word, cult retreated to a wooden lodge in the backwoods of Lee, Mississippi, disappeared for 9 months because what they were doing was he was following instructions that he recorded in his book, this story, following divine instructions to build a robot messiah, essentially, out of parts of wire, copper, and parts of a dining room table. And then he anointed one of his female followers as the new Mary. And that was her title. And in a very elaborate ceremony, she was to give birth to this robotic messiah. Obviously, it didn't quite work out that way. And he writes that afterwards that, well, I'm very grateful for the time and the revelations that have allowed me to see beyond the clouds and the secrets that the spirits have bestowed upon me. But now I must move off to my next adventure. And he was never seen or heard from again. And so that's this weird little pocket in history that I'm not sure would really fit in many other books. It's specifically, it crammed into this book. But it did, again, it made me think, okay, so if this is on a shelf, what do we put next? What do we put beside this? And that led to this story from 1933 of a Shinto priest in Japan who discovered documents, so the story goes, that appeared to be, written in Japanese, the last will and testament of Jesus Christ. Now, what happened with this, it's actually led to a physical fallout of consequences where there is a village called Shingo, which is about 7 hours north of Tokyo, where thousands of Christian pilgrims still make the journey every year to visit this one village because everyone in this village believes they are related to Jesus Christ, because in these documents, which unfortunately disappeared during the war, it was claimed that Jesus actually sneaked away from the crucifixion. His brother helpfully took his place. Jesus fled to Japan, where he lived to a grand old age as a farmer, but he was described as looking a bit like a goblin. I hope I'm not offending anyone, but this is what the document claimed. And lived to an age of farming, having grandchildren, where he died. And to this day, again, I include a picture of this. You can visit his grave, which is beautiful little grave with white picket fencing and a plaque explaining the story, maintained by the local yogurt factory. And there's a gift shop. You can buy Japanese Jesus coasters and mugs and things. But this bizarre story, which has gone on for decades and has a real world impact, all came out of this, I'm going to go out on a limb and say, forged document. So, and again, it's like you said, it's another example of this bizarre eccentric episode born out of a curious bit of writing.
How did you go about finding and collecting all of these stories and manuscripts?
Yes, it was about 10 years of research, but also I'm the son of, my dad was a rare book dealer. I grew up in a rare book shop. And when you're, I'm sure as other people have found, when you're not an expert in a particular subject, the way someone tries to get you interested is to tell you the most interesting part, the most curious thing that they can think of in that field. And so that's what I was used to seeing. I was used to seeing maps on the walls and being most curious about the ones with sea monsters, you know, and it sort of goes on from there. But from having this perspective of being inside the rare book world, the antiquarian book world, which I think from the outside by a lot of people is maybe viewed as quite a dry, crusty, grey-haired, old, locked-off world, was to show with these stories is that actually it's just a bit like a geode. You know, from the outside, it's unremarkable. You crack it open, there's amazing, glittering things inside. And to show how exciting a rare book auction or rare book catalogue is to flick through if, for example, you've never come across it or thought that it was just a closed off world. So it's from there, I just talked to a lot of rare book dealers as much as I talk to librarians, because dealers have a great magpie eye for a good story. They know exactly how to hook your interest in something that you never thought you would be interested in. And they're also very sort of generous in contributing images to the book, because I think you have to. I mean, it's heavily, heavily illustrated, this book, deliberately, because I think otherwise there'd be a risk of not quite believing what you were reading, thinking it was all just sort of repeated nonsense from earlier works.
As you say, there are a lot of illustrations in here, and some of the most eye-popping, shall we say, come from a 1775 work called The Compendium. Is it The Compendium of Demonology and Magic? It's a real shame that this is an audio format and we can't kind of share this share the pictures with our audience. But I wonder if you could explain a bit about this book and why it is so attention grabbing, let's say.
Yeah, I think, well, this seemed like an obvious chapter to have to really focus on, to find, go through the history of grimoires, even though that was a later term for, you know, magical manuscripts, and find the most curious and, yeah, and like you say, this visually stunning, because in 1775, of course, the book is actually dated to the 11th century by its author, which was a standard tactic in producing grimoires because A, it made them seem much more mysterious to be filled with ancient knowledge, but it also protected the author with as little information about who created it as possible, save them from being thrown onto the same bonfire that the book was being thrown onto. But yes, this manuscript that's informally known as the Compendium of Demonology and Magic is in the collection of the Wellcome Library in London. And what you find, because it's written at a point in time where obviously the hysteria over witchcraft has subsided, a bit of common sense has entered into the general discourse, and it's realized that not everything can be blamed on witches and women specifically. And what you find is this artist is working with much more freer sense of artistic license. So he's really embellishing it, or she is embellishing every detail. And so what you find, as well as standard repeated grimoire information, the standard incantations and spells about how to summon demons, there's a lot of warnings in here as well. And one of my favorite illustrations, and you wouldn't believe the amount of back and forth emailing I had to do with my publisher about how many devil penises are we allowed to show? Is this going to be a problem internationally? One of my favorite illustrations is of a pair of treasure hunting men who have brought all the right equipment. They followed the instructions of earlier grimoires. They brought their book of spells, their lamp. You can see their shovels with them. They've dug a hole in the ground because this was the most popular use of magic, to find buried treasure. And then all of a sudden you see an enormous, conservatively 9 foot tall demon with a cockerel head, enormous claws, enormous demon tackle, which he's using to urinate on their lamp, while also seizing one of the treasure hunters, forms a pretty unambiguous warning against this practice. Because I think there's a book called, I mentioned later, a book in the same genre of, it's called The Book of Buried Pearls. And what was astounding about coming across this story following this compendium of demonology was that the issue with treasure hunting for buried treasure, was a huge problem in Egypt. And in fact, it was described by one minister in the government in the early 20th century as being more damaging to their landscape and their physical cultural heritage than all the wars that had occurred in Egypt, because people were going absolutely nuts digging everything up, following the guidance of this this grimoire, this book that claimed to know secret divine sourced knowledge of where treasure was hidden in the desert by the pyramids. And so what's interesting is seeing books that we generally view, these magical works, as being representative of locked off in a certain period, that sort of grey line between science and religion and fantasy, as that being something just sort of self-contained in this lost episode of history. But they carry on, and then we sort of reach the realm of spiritualist writing. And this fashion is Victorian turned Edwardian and on fashion of mediums channeling ghosts, producing books of poetry, which I've really enjoyed trying to sort of collect as well. So the spiritual world, the demonic world, is still alive and well in terms of literary tradition. I think I even include a picture of a guide to occultism produced for American law enforcement, how to spot if a cult has been sacrificing to Satan in the local area. Apparently skulls and shaved heads is a dead giveaway that there's child sacrifice going on in a basement. So it's a fascinating world to dip in to, and then a big relief to dip out of at the end.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
with art in the art world, art collecting, where people often say, well, that's very expensive. Wouldn't you just want a photocopy of it or a nice reproduction? But to me, that's always like offering a hungry person a photograph of a sandwich. It's just not going to be the same thing.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
I think, as you say, the imagination involved in the creation of some of these supernatural texts is just mind-boggling, but almost as intriguing as the works of pure imagination are the works that are trying to replicate reality, but now we know to not quite be accurate. So I'm thinking of, say, books of medieval beasts, where they're trying to recreate animals, for example, that they've never seen, that kind of thing. And you say that quite often the errors in encyclopedias or books of knowledge, especially when you go back to, say, like the medieval era, are often the things that really make them the most charming.
Yes, I think definitely, I think we can be quite snobby and hasty to judge. There are a lot of memes that go around on the internet of, you know, look at this, these medieval artists believed animals to look like this, when we've completely, that's not taking into account a huge amount of information that's presented satirically in this artistic form. It's not just that no one had seen an alligator and so they just guessed at it. Obviously, that is what they had to do. But we've lost a whole sort of code of language, a visual code in these drawings of how we interpreted the world, how skeptical we are of rumor. Perhaps drawing an animal in an exaggerated way is a way of ridiculing a written description that has been received very sort of unverifiably. But definitely, yeah, on the theme of collections, that was, again, a running theme that obviously had to be explored, because you have to include the medieval bestiaries, which is featuring what you've mentioned, what we've discussed. But what you find in that world is these authors are just the type of person that you mentioned earlier, people who were obsessed and completely driven. Quite often people who produced incredibly wide-ranging collections focused on a very specific area. And so what's really interesting is seeing what these collectors, what their singular passion was. And so, for example, there's a manuscript from, I believe, the 16th century called the Fish Book. And it's this enormous, enormous collection of everything to do with marine life, everything that was known at that time, these beautiful full page illustrations. But for the author, there was literally no other form of interest. This was the pursuit of his life. And And obviously, this is something that continues to this day. I mean, I've always loved Francis Gross and his book, which is still has come back into fashion now, the Dictionary of the Vulgar Tongue. But I love the idea of someone going out into the world and saying, you know, I am going to collect all this information. Past sources maybe can't be trusted. We need them. We need a contemporary snapshot. So I love these kinds of pioneers. Or social explorers who gather all this information, because what better sense of a particular time, what better sense of back alley Georgian life can you get than from reading Francis Gross's nocturnal explorations with his terrified assistant leading him down, down to the docks, down to sort of the hardest pubs and so on, and collecting all these slang terms.
I think you've got to be a very particular type of person to embark on a project like a dictionary or an encyclopedia, haven't you?
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely. And in fact, I wonder how well known is it. It's become better known recently because there was a great book by Simon Winchester, Surgeon of Crowthorne is the title. And it's just about the origins of the Oxford Dictionary, the first Oxford Dictionary when it was produced. And because obviously this... there hadn't been a concise dictionary produced since Dr. Johnson. It was an enormous project, and the organizers very early on realized they were going to need to crowdsource it. It's one great early example of crowdsourcing. So appeals were posted in bookshops and libraries for the public to submit definitions and example sentences of all the words they can think of. And one of the most prolific providers of information, going over 10 years, was a gentleman, was a doctor stationed at, let's say, a hospital, and who struck up a friendship with the main compiler of the dictionary. For 10 years, they became great friends with this pen pal relationship. And after a while, there was a desire to meet up. They wanted to meet in person. And this doctor says, well, I will agree to this, having declined for 10 years, but you must come to me. So he gives him the train station to catch a train to. I said, I'll send you a carriage. Carriage is waiting there. It leads up to this great country house. The lexicographer is led into this grand office where a man is standing there and says, my friend, it's so good to finally meet you. And the man turns around and says, oh, no, I'm actually the superintendent of Broadmoor. The person you want is actually one of our patients, a murderer. So that's, again, a very sort of startling example of an origin, an eccentric story to the origin of something that we take for granted. It's very sort of mundane in a way, the dictionary. So it's wonderful to see these things in new lights.
Oh, yeah, completely. Another thing that you look at, which brought a few chuckles, was literary hoaxes. What are some of the wittiest or most ingenious?
Literary hoaxes, I've always been fond of collecting because they're not expensive. Not very many people are interested in them. Perhaps they're viewed as being a bit silly, but they are wonderful stories. And it's an ancient art. It goes right back to, well, for example, there's the story of Alexander of Abinatakos, an ancient Greek. We're talking 2nd century AD, who founded a prophetic snake cult by doctoring tablets, creating this hoax literature, burying it in a shallow grave in a temple, waiting for it to be discovered. And these tablets proclaimed that the god of the local temple was looking for a rebranding, wanted to be known as Glycon, was now a snake deity. And so when the tablets were discovered, Alexander arrived in his prophet's robes, declared himself the earthly communicatory vessel of this god, and founded this cult that we know from archaeological evidence existed, the cult of Glycon existed for at least 100 years following his death. And apparently he held sway over his followers, using tricks. And it's the Syrian writer Lucian, who is the sole source of the story, who tells us that Alexander essentially had a snake sock puppet, and that's how he managed to sounds ridiculous, how he managed to just convince his followers to be transfixed in their faith, which apparently he sort of operated it using invisible horse hairs. And it was this sock puppet snake that would communicate the information from Glycon, which Alexander was able to provide because he would secretly read the questions that the followers would submit, thinking they were private. And what's amazing is that in the 90s, when a Romanian train station was being refurbished, they dug up and discovered a marble statue, a snake statue of Glycon. And it was celebrated, this discovery, on a national banknote in 1995. And I put photos of both of these things in the book, again, to sort of prove that this was a real thing. But, I mean, literary hoaxes, they range over the centuries. And one great discovery was to find that one of my favorite stories, which is sort of legendary among book dealers and catalogers, is the story of the Fort Sass affair, which was just this tiny little event in Belgium, which is probably the weirdest event in literary history that's ever occurred, when in 1840, a catalogue was sent to the big collectors and libraries of Europe of around, I think, about 80 books. But each title was stupendously rare. Most of them had never been heard of. Each one valued today at least £250,000 each, the value of them. And they were from the rarest printers. They were accounts of the sort of nefarious activities of European royals, and so there was this mad scramble across the continent to descend on this tiny little town of Binche in Belgium to attend this auction of the private collection of the Comte de Fort Sass, this very eccentric and wealthy count. And hurtling towards this town in carriages was an emissary of the Princess de Ligne, who had been informed that there might be embarrassing information about the sexual exploits of her grandfather in there. There were stories about disgusting details of the scrofula of kings. There were basically representatives of every major library who had been given essentially blank checks to collect these works. So there was this mad sort of bibliomaniacal bloodlust in the air. They all turn up at this town and run around searching for the auction house on Rue de l'Église. And the first problem came when they couldn't find that actual street. And when they questioned locals, no one had ever heard of the Count Forsas. They'd never heard of the street. They weren't aware of the auction. But then posters were printed up saying, "Oh, I'm terribly sorry for the confusion. All the books have been actually presented to the town library and you can inquire about them there." But this caused more confusion because there was no town library. And for 13 years, there was no solution to this. The catalogue had been completely invented by someone. The count was completely fictional. Obviously, all the books were fictional. And it was this bizarre little blip in history until one day the town printer finally revealed that it was just a retired soldier who had thought he'd have a little fun. And it was only then, this gentleman named Renier, that people remembered seeing him among these panicked crowds, enjoying himself immensely at all the confusion. And the best discovery out of this whole story, personally, for me, was discovering that it was my great-great-uncle, who was William Blades, a printer, who produced the first English translation of this catalogue. Clearly we shared the same kind of sense of humour. So it was a lot of fun, yeah.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of people having just a merry old time in this book, and people playing around with language is another example of that, to faintly ridiculous degrees. So people writing, for example, the shortest poem in the world or the longest novel. What were some of the feats like that took your fancy?
I really enjoy the shortest play supposedly ever written, which is set in a sort of mountain lodge of a pioneer. And there's a knock at the door. The pioneer gets up, answers the door. And there's a man standing there saying, "Please help me. There's a bounty on my head." And the pioneer says, "How much?" That's it. That's the end of the play. So yes, exactly. Finding little nuggets like that. But I think it's because I work as a writer for a TV show, QI, and the all day, every day during the writing period of that show is searching for these kinds of nuggets and searching for ways to stitch them together. So this sort of book works in that same sort of way.
I think before I move on to my kind of concluding questions, I do just have to throw in one question, which is, I need you to tell us the story of the bookfish.
When you're looking for a good story to a book, I guess one of the best kinds of stories is a, a book that has appeared out of nowhere. There's, for example, there's a book, there's a story of the Liber Linteus in there, which was the wrappings of a mummy that a Croatian diplomat bought during the Egyptomania in the 1840s, that only in 1890, when the mummy had been donated to the Zagreb Museum, that they realized that the mummy was actually wrapped in strips of linen that was an Etruscan manuscript, and that at one point had been a 3 meter wide canvas telling this story. So another example of that was the Bookfish, where the story goes, in 1626 at the Cambridge fish market, a suspiciously fat codfish was sliced open by the fishwife, and out slid this rather goopy cloth parcel. And when she unwrapped the cloth, she found a copy of the book, which was called Preparation to the Cross. And the funny thing about this is that this event was confirmed by Dr. Joseph Mead of Christ College, Cambridge, when he wrote to St. Martin Studeville and said, you know, when I first saw it, I didn't believe it, but it seemed almost turned into a jelly and consumed. And I saw it with my own eyes, you know, the fish, the piece of sailcloth, the book. And it's obviously it stunk as well. And it turned out that 100 years earlier, a Protestant writer named John Frith had been kept prisoner by Cardinal Wolsey in a fish cellar, and had written this book, Preparation for the Cross. And somehow a copy of this book, and no one ever established how, found its way into this fish's belly. So when the story gets out 100 years later after the discovery, the book is reprinted, republished with the subtitle, it's called Vox Piscis, or Voice of the Fish, or The Bookfish Containing Three Treaties Which Were Found in the Belly of a Codfish. And it even included a helpful little woodcut illustration as the frontispiece, showing the fish stall and the fish sliced open and the pages peeking out. It's a bizarre story.
It's a lovely story. So this book very much is about books' physical form as much as the contents of the books themselves. Do you fear about the future of books?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a funny thing. Someone else asked me that recently, and the first thing it brought to mind was a quote from Stephen Fry, who said that at the time when the Kindle was becoming popular, he said, I think the Kindle is as much a threat to the book as an escalator is to a staircase. I think when you've handled, especially when you've handled antiquarian books, there's nothing like the smell of a rare bookshop when you sort of dink in through the door, and this wall of perfume hits you. And dealers like my dad, for example, who they can date a book purely from the smell of the paper and the bindings. They can tell you where this paper was produced and when. I can't imagine anything that can replace the sensory experience of handling books. I just still very uncomfortable reading books on a screen. I'm not trying to reject it. I'm not trying, you know, it's just very uncomfortable. And to me, it's always seemed a bit like with art in the art world, art collecting, where people often say, well, that's very expensive. Wouldn't you just want a photocopy of it or a nice reproduction? But to me, that's always like offering a hungry person a photograph of a sandwich. It's just not going to be the same thing.
So say you had a secret fortune stashed away somewhere. I don't know, you might do, but that you could use to acquire, just one book or manuscript to keep in your own personal collection, what do you think you'd go for?
I think it's a toss-up, isn't it? Because would you want something very visual when you get bored of the actual writing? Would you want something that contains so many more words in it? At the same time, I mean, for me, one of the most exciting areas of history is the history of exploration, particularly polar exploration, when there's less sort of problematic, colonial issues going on, and it's more about bravery and heroism, and you know. And one of the most interesting books from that time is called The Aurora Australis, which was produced by Shackleton's expedition, I think 1908. It's the first book written, illustrated, printed, and bound in the Antarctic. It's beautiful. They had to write the book with ink, print it with ink, just sort of held over candlelight to stop the ink from instantly freezing. And they bound it in, it's a very rare, I think only sort of 40 or 50 copies, but they bound it in the boards of the tea case of their expedition. So each copy is unique. And when you open one, there's sort of strips of the original lettering of these supply crates in there. And it's such a good example of a book that is more than a book. It just evokes so much. It's so sort of tactile. It's an artifact along with everything else. And I can't imagine you would ever get bored of breaking that open and just smelling it, sensing the adventure, especially as in the future, you know, who knows how long the Antarctic in the form that we know of it is going to last. So I think it's this amazing time capsule that just sucks you into this other world of adventure.
That was Edward Brooke Hitching. The Madman's Library, The Greatest Curiosities of Literature, is available now, published by Simon & Schuster. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. Tune in tomorrow to hear a lecture on German Jews in the First World War.